Welcome to the Do Your Good podcast series. In this podcast series, you'll hear from me, Sybil, and other experts in the field to help you make your money matter and make a huge difference in the world. I come to you with over two decades of experience as a person who's helped donors give away over $45 million in donations, both large and small. This podcast series is meant to give you the tools you need to be effective in the world and fund nonprofits and issues that you care about with meaning and purpose, and to make a true, deep difference in the world. Hello, everyone. If you listened to my interview with Rachel Humphrey last week, you'll have heard us talk about something called trust-based philanthropy. And Rachel is a leader in the Justice Funders Network and is thinking a lot about how do we as donors show up for the nonprofits we care about and not stand in the way of the work. So we really allow the nonprofit to get that work done and not have them do so much administrative work just to sort of prove themselves that they then spend so much time fundraising that they can't take the time really to get the job done. And so one thing we talked about was this concept of trust-based philanthropy. And I'm so happy to tell you that I interviewed one of the leaders, the co-founders of the concept and idea of trust-based philanthropy, John Esterly, about a year or so ago. And so I'm offering you that interview today because I find it really interesting. It's important to think through how we as donors can make sure that while we want to make a difference in the world, we also trust in the nonprofits to get the job done, that they know best how to do this. However, this can sometimes be really challenging because us as donors, we also have this great perspective on the problem we're trying to solve. We talk to so many people, and we're also thinking of it a lot of times from a place of abundance. We have the funding, we have the resources, we can get the work done, and we can support the nonprofits in thinking in that way too, because sometimes nonprofits will get very much focused in their own specific project they want to get done. And they're so worried about funding that they may not always think that, maybe we can raise more money for this project if we do it and pitch it the right way. So there's this interesting dynamic where we can really help each other, but sometimes, as you all know, if you give money away and try to make your money matter, sometimes you feel like you're standing in the way of progress. And I know that can be challenging. So this interview with John Esterly, where we talk about trust-based philanthropy, we're talking about one strategy that will allow you as a donor to support the nonprofit to get the job done. All right, have a good listen. Thanks.
John, I'm so glad you're on my podcast today. Thank you for participating in this conversation. I wanted to interview you because so many of my other guests that I've had on this podcast series have talked about trust-based philanthropy. They bring it up over and over and they love it and they feel so validated. And you, as I understand it, are one of the founders of trust-based philanthropy. So I'm so happy to talk to you today because I'd love to unpack what this means, how people can really use it in their daily practice of giving. But before we go there, let's first talk about you and your personal journey to philanthropy.
Thanks, Sybil. And again, appreciate the invitation to be part of this conversation with you today in this podcast series. So I'm John Esterly. I'm the co-executive director of the Whitman Institute, which is an independent foundation in San Francisco with a mission to advance equity through funding, dialogue, relationship building, and inclusive leadership. That's the official mission. We've been making grants since 2005. And I'll get into the story of, you know, how trust-based philanthropy evolved from that point on. But just to back up a bit in terms of my own story, I started at the Whitman Institute in 1988. I had done some background work before then in nonprofits, most notably leading a pilot project called Crime in the News Media back in the mid-1980s that brought together proponents of alternatives to incarceration and local journalists. I came to the Institute with a broad interest in dialogue, critical thinking, thinking about thinking. So when I discovered this quirky small operating foundation with a mission of promoting better thinking and decision making, I was intrigued and started working there in 1988. The founder, Fred Whitman, was still alive then, and he was actively on the scene with the Institute up until his death in 2004. So I had a very up and down tenure in terms of the program work there. He was a difficult personality in many ways, had a lot of good qualities, but I had my own experiences working with a founder donor that informed what would later become how I approached philanthropy. Because we had an interest in programs when we were an operating foundation, both in critical thinking and philanthropy, we had one project called looking at how family dynamics affect family decision making. For a long time, I had just this thought of, well, someday the Institute, what if we brought this interest in critical thinking and philanthropy together and contributed to the wider conversation about how people practice grant making? So when Fred Whitman died in 2004, he was estranged from all his kids, so he left the foundation basically to me to lead. I was the executive director at that time. And I made this shift at that point in time from us being an operating foundation to a grant-making foundation. And thus really started our trust-based philanthropy journey. When I approached grant-making, we were small. I was the only full-time staff member. And my current co-executive director, Pia Infante, joined me on a part-time basis. So when we first started making grants, there were some approaches that just made inherent sense to me. And one of those was giving unrestricted grants. To me, to my mind, if we were in alignment with what you were doing, we were supporting you, you knew how best to spend the money. And so we didn't put any restrictions on that. And I think that came both from my own background with nonprofits, what I heard from other people. And I think also, probably on a more personal level, my experience with Fred Whitman, I really wanted to minimize the hoops people had to jump through to get access to the funds. So along with unrestricted funding, we didn't require traditional proposals or reports. It was like, if you've written something for somebody else, I'll read all that. But we, right from the beginning, didn't require traditional proposals and reports, but accompanied that with an invitation to relationship for a foundation with a big interest in dialogue and relationship building. It was like, how do we invite more authentic dialogic relationships with those we're supporting? And so it was really an invitation into both a learning relationship two-way, and also an offer of how can we be supportive beyond our check if there are ways that make sense to you. So we just practiced our grant making in this way for a number of years going forward, and we didn't call it anything, but we made the decision in 2011, 2012 to spend out as a foundation. And at that time, having made that decision, we thought a good first step for us would be just to check our own assumptions about our work. And we contracted with the Center for Effective Philanthropy to do a grantee perception report. And the results we got back from that were quite affirming in terms of our relationships with our grantee partners, the way we did our work. And that, so that was gratifying to hear. But going forward, what really informed our work were two things that came out of that report. One, we were able to ask an open-ended question, and we asked our grantee partners, what are your ideas about how we best leverage our funds as we look to spending out in 10 years? And what we heard back across the board was a call to advocate for how we fund within philanthropy. And then CEP said, there's also this theme that comes up in people's written comments that we want to highlight for you. And that's how important it is that people feel trusted by you. So we sat with that feedback, this urge to advocate and organize within philanthropy, along with this theme for trust. And it was out of that that came our naming and framing of what we do as trust-based philanthropy. And we broke it into concrete steps that for us make up that approach, multi-year unrestricted funding, streamlined paperwork, what we call doing the homework, which is the onus is on the funder to see if somebody is a good match and do a lot of the background vetting themselves. What we call support beyond the check, which is basically a range of lots of different things that can be helpful to your grantee partners, from opening doors to other funders, highlighting and advocating for people's work, being a sounding board and just an empathic listener sometimes, other times being invited into strategy discussions, a whole variety of things, including periodically bringing our grantee partners together for retreats with our board and other nonprofit leaders and later people in philanthropy. Those became kind of signature events for us. And also a commitment to open and transparent communication and listening and acting on feedback. Those are the kind of the basic principles. None of them new, of course, and we've always been clear about that. For us, this frame has really been an organizing frame within philanthropy to invite funders to change practices that have been very resistant to widespread change. And I think with trust-based philanthropy, what we talk about is they're not just like a checkbox of items. They really generate their own power when you practice them all together. And I would just add on the theme of power that really with our work with the Trust-Based Philanthropy Project, that's what this is really about. Trust-based philanthropy, as we've been talking about it, is really trying to shift the traditional power dynamics within philanthropy between funders and nonprofits, and really ground this work in values of racial equity. That's the spirit that drives the project now for the moment.
That was so wonderful, John. And thank you for those steps and the key components of trust-based philanthropy. And for our listeners, we are going to have the link to the trust-based philanthropy website in the show notes so that people can easily access it and to all the other things that you reference in this conversation. So that's really important. And now for an ad, but John has much more information to offer. So stay tuned. Hello, everyone. I want to let you know that I am putting forward a pretty exciting new podcast season, which is going to focus on the journey I took with one of my clients to think through effective funding strategies to reduce firearm-related suicide in rural and remote communities, specifically looking at Oregon as an example. So tune in to my podcast series, September 30th through October 21st. Every Monday, I'll have a new special episode specifically discussing this issue. Thanks a lot. One thing, John, you and I have talked about sort of offline that I want to bring into this conversation before we get into more of the fundamentals. You lay out a nice, clear set of potential, I don't even necessarily want to say rules, but potential aspects of practice that if you want to be a funder that really adheres to trust-based philanthropy, it's important to follow. However, you and I also talked about how a foundation can incorporate elements of the concepts within trust-based philanthropy, but they don't have to necessarily hold every single tenet. So for example, some foundations are not spending down, and also some foundations can't really do multi-year grants because of a variety of reasons. Or some foundations, they don't necessarily, because of the way they're funding, they can't necessarily have no proposals, but they might be able to have a different kind of modified proposal. So the things that we talked about, I sort of want to unpack that a little more, because one thing I want to be sure of is that a foundation or a person who's interested in giving money to nonprofits effectively, that just because they can't meet every single one of your tenets of trust-based philanthropy, that doesn't mean they should turn it off. But instead, you and I have talked about, okay, well, how do the fundamental tenet of what you've been talking about is fostering authentic relationships and trying to shift that center of power to the nonprofits rather than the funder. And you have tools for us to do that. But let's talk a little more about it's not one size fits all, but there's still a home for people in trust-based philanthropy, even if they can't meet all of the things that you list in the trust-based philanthropy framework. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, thanks for that. And this is a very important part of the discussion to have, because there's the practices, but again, these practices, there's underlying values to them. That's what we really want people to look at and step into even before the practices. So I would say, for me, no matter what you're doing, to be approaching partnership in a spirit of service. That's kind of an ethos and a spirit that underlies this that I think it's important to bring. However you're looking at these practices of multi-year funding or whatever, to have that really rooted in a sense of service, a sense of partnership, bringing humility to the work, curiosity, commitment to listening. These things that open up a more genuine relationship. So I would say that underlies that. And then as the project has evolved from us advocating on our own to later becoming what it now is, which is a collaborative funder initiative, the Trust-Based Philanthropy Project, is that what we have found and learned over time is everybody has different ways of approaching this because we all do our work somewhat differently. So we found with multi-year unrestricted funding, for some, they can't give multi-year commitments because maybe they're public foundations and they're raising what they're giving away every year, or some have some other constraint. So whether you're able to make an outfront 3 or 5 year commitment, which is great, but if you're not able to do that, to go, well, can we sustain support over time? So we're not just giving 1 year grants. I'd say unrestricted funding is an important element. And that's not to say that sometimes there might be a reason why somebody's doing a specific project grant. And our experience has been when you provide unrestricted funding over time, and people have a sense that you're going to be supporting them over time, that opens up the space for deeper and more honest conversations as time goes on, especially being able to talk about challenges, talking about what doesn't work. Because a lot of times people are reluctant to talk about what's not working because they think they'll get penalized for that.
Right. Those are great points, John. And the other thing that I wanted to add to that from what you were talking about is, for example, one of my clients, Jubitz Family Foundation, we do yearly grants, but we do something called anchor groups. We support anchor groups. They're mm-hmm. groups that know maybe it's year-to-year grants, but they're pretty sure they're going to get those grants for year after year because they meet so clearly what the family cares about.
And now for an ad, but John has much more information to offer, so stay tuned.
Hello, everyone. I'm so glad that you're enjoying my podcast. In my podcast, I hope to talk to you, the wonderful donors and philanthropists that I work with, to help you think through the most effective way to make your money matter. I also, in my podcast series and through all my trainings, want to help and support the nonprofits that are out there trying to raise money and hone their pitch. Because I'm somebody that works with donors, I get pitched all the time by amazing nonprofit leaders, so I know what it takes to raise money effectively. Please check out everything I have to offer at www.doyourgood.com. I have a whole host of course materials and lessons, videos, downloadable documents, a blog that I keep updated. All of it is 100% free for you to see and review and learn from. Please check it out. Again, www.doyourgood.com. Thanks a lot. The thing I also wanted to dig in with you on this is one thing you talked about, John, and we talked about this a little bit offline too, is if you have a deep relationship with groups and you're doing capacity grants that are really supporting the groups, a lot of times what I've found is that the groups will come together and they'll say to me, Sybil, there's like six of us that your clients or the folks you work with are funding. We all think that there needs to be some major campaign on a particular issue that we all care about. Maybe forest protection reform or climate change issues. And they say, we actually need you to help us do specific targeted grants for us all to work together to change this one particular thing. And so that's what I sort of think of as like campaign grants. And I think sometimes it feels like you can still do campaign grants that are very targeted and project oriented, as long as the groups are telling you they want this to happen, but that it's augmenting something that they've all told you they need. I feel like I want to dig into that a little more with you because, you know, I would hate to have nonprofits or charities feel like they can't come to us with extra special targeted work.
You actually put that rather well. So all I'll do is kind of underline what you said. Yes, I think you can give campaign grants. You could give a more targeted thing, but I think the point you raise is really the key one. Is this something that your grantee partners are asking for? One of the trust-based philanthropy principles, you're listening and you're acting on feedback. And in that case, it would be a collective ask to fund a campaign. That would make a lot of sense. And then I think within that, it's and then also saying, and we trust you to run this campaign as makes sense to you. We're not going to go, well, we'll give the money for the campaign, and this is how we want you to do it.
Yeah. And you know what, John, you picked on something really important. I feel like one of the big problems is that too often us funders, we do the problematic thing, which you just said, which we say, oh, this campaign sounds great. So, and then we stop listening. And that's where it can be really tricky if you're doing campaign type funding or helping a group launch something. And so there's a lot of things that all of us, I think, need to be careful of when we do that funding. It shouldn't stop us from doing it. It's just, we need to be sure. I think there's more of a potential for us to lean into the problematic practices of funding. If we're doing those campaign type grants, we have to keep listening, keep supporting the groups. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So helpful.
Yeah. And that to me relates back to things I was saying about just approaching from a spirit of service and humility, always kind of leading with listening. It doesn't mean that a funder has to never contribute any of their own thinking or thoughts, but it's from my experience, when that is most productive is when you're asked to contribute those things rather than starting off saying, you know, we're the experts and we want you to carry
John, I've been in rooms where a funder has said, this is the perfect one. I just read an article. Right. And you have all the experts of whatever it is. You know, I was on the airplane and I read an article and this is what it said we need to do. So this is what we need to do. What do you all think? I'm like, oh no, cringe.
Yeah.
You know, that's not good.
Not good.
The good thing to do is, okay, everybody, experts in the room, tell us what you think needs to happen. You said there's a problem that needs to be solved and how can we help you? Yeah, totally.
Yeah. You know, and then I think for, well, like you were saying, that kind of the nuance with some of the other practices, like another one is the streamlining paperwork. People can take different approaches to that. If in our case, we don't accept unsolicited proposals and we're a proactive grant maker in that way. Other foundations that take open proposals, well, they're going to have some sort of mechanism for receiving proposals. So then how do they approach that? And in that case, we just say approach however you're thinking of proposals with this thought of how do we make this as simple and accessible as possible for anyone to write a proposal. Same thing with, reports. I think we're always like, well, even if you don't require reports, some people say, well, we'd still like a report, but if you've written something for somebody else, just send us that. You know, we don't need our own proposal. So I think with both the proposals and reports, it's also, that's why it's important to hold these with values around equity, because I think sometimes the hurdles that funders put up actually can screen out the very communities they're saying they're wanting to serve. Another just point I'd make about the practices that we have found is that if you practice them together, they reinforce each other and allow you to move in different ways. So in other words, if you're providing support, unrestricted support over time, that frees up the need for a lot of the proposal and reporting process. In turn, that frees up your time to provide more support beyond the check. So time can often be an obstacle that people talk about when they look at building more authentic relationships with their portfolio of grantee partners.
John, really, really good advice. And there, while you were talking, I was thinking about something in terms of with some of the folks that I've worked with or that I know who look at proposals from nonprofits. One place I see a lot of folks go is they focus in very much on organizations' budgets. So, you know, if they're a little in the red or if there's some funky piece of them, they get the some of my clients, and not just my clients, but lots of folks I work with, they tend to really hone in on that more than the substance sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I value that review and it is important to look at organizations that are nonprofits and make sure that the budgets are not, you know, that the organization is healthy. The question I have for you though is I have a feeling you've pondered this. How important do you think it is to really dig into an organization's budget? And if it's in the red or if it's a little wiggly, you know, how much time do you ask that organization to spend on the budget versus the overall mission and vision of the organization and what they're trying to get done? Especially if you're doing multi-year grants that sort of rely on the long-term longevity of the organization. But at the same time, you know, how worried do you get about budgets and that kind of thing?
That's a good question. I think, you know, our answer to that is we haven't ever, you know, required a lot of information on budgets or dug deep into those. Depending on the budgets can even be a very fungible, flexible kind of thing that even sometimes they're ideal budgets versus, you know, what was actually spent. But I would say we don't dig into the budgets and ask what's the spending here, how come this, how come that. I mean, I think one budget thing that we'll ask our grantee partners or look for is, you know, how much do you have in reserves? Because for me, that's often a strong sign of financial health. If somebody actually does have a reserve, and that's where we have been fine. When we say unrestricted funds, they are truly unrestricted. If you would want to use our money to build up your reserve, that's fine.
Great point, John. And it's funny because we're so in the same line on that, because I was just thinking that's my main thing too, is the reserve. The reserves are important because especially with this with the COVID situation and other things, I really saw it play out there. So I love what you're saying. And it does sound like, you know, you're not really as worried about the budget overall, the little teeny line item pieces. It's more the overall mission, vision, is the organization healthy, and making sure that they have enough in reserve so they can bounce back if it's a hard time.
Yeah. And then that's also the thing of over time, when you're in relationship with people and they feel that they can talk to you about challenges. Sometimes those challenges have been, we were striking out with funders. We didn't raise what we thought we were going to this year. These are our challenges around that. And so you actually get, I think, sometimes a more authentic sense how organizations are doing financially, because they're telling you.
Great. Yeah, great. That sounds great. So, John, I would love it now if we go, you've been sort of teasing the audience here, where you're saying, we're going to talk about some of those, let's list the fundamental things to think about with trust-based philanthropy one more time, so that folks can really get that down. And again, you have such a great, or the Coalition of Funders working on this has such a great website too, that'll be in the show notes, that really lays all this out as well. But can you summarize that again for me? I'd love to hear it.
Yeah. So the practices as we frame them are, multi-year unrestricted funding. And as we've talked about, multi-year means really support over time if you're not able to make multi-year commitments. But the unrestricted funding is a really key element. Second practice is what we call do the homework, which is that the onus is on the funder to do the research, the background research, the vetting, to see if an organization is the right partner for them. And they can do that financially, looking at 990s. They can be reading whatever materials are available. They can talk to other people, et cetera. But really, you're taking on the work of seeing, is this person a good match for our organization, a good match for us? Along with that, then, is what we call streamlined paperwork, which is really being thoughtful and intentional about minimizing the work people have to go through in terms of either proposals or reports. In terms of proposals, if you're asking for proposals, it's really making them as simple and accessible as possible, and really focusing on what is it that you really need to know to make an informed decision about funding somebody. And on the report end, what we have found is, instead of reports, consider having a learning conversation or conversations over time with people. Some people also say, if you've written a proposal for a report for another funder, just send us that. Same thing with a proposal. If you've written a proposal for somebody else, just send us that, and that's all we need. But the aim there is to, again, really minimize the time and energy that goes into proposals and reporting. Because what we just hear back from people is they're drowning in paperwork. And often the amount of time that goes into applying for a grant and reporting for a grant, really almost, it's so out of proportion sometimes to the level of support that they're getting. So the fourth is listening and acting on feedback. And it's the listening from the people you're supporting. And acting on feedback doesn't mean you have to act on every single thing that you hear from organizations and communities, but it does mean you do act some of the time. I think there, for all the talk about listening within philanthropy and funders listening, I think there's a degree of frustration, jadedness, cynicism that can come from people when they see lots of listening, but no action based on the listening. So for us, that's always been important that we act on what we hear. One example of that would be why we started the trust-based philanthropy framing and work. Open and transparent communication. You really model that, you embody that, and invite people into more direct and empathic conversation. And that really opens up the possibility for a deeper relationship. But I just want to make the point with relationships, we don't require people necessarily to be in relationship with us. It's really an invitation. And so how that manifests can look different for different people and organizations. Some years we'll have pretty frequent contact with folks. Other years, not so much. Some people, they're like, hey, we're good. Thanks. We'll check in with you down the line a few months, and that's fine. But I want to make the point that when you have a commitment to relationships, it's acknowledging there's going to be a whole spectrum of what those relationships looks like. And that leads me into the final practice of support beyond the check. Because what we have found around that practice is there's all kinds of ways that you can be supportive beyond the check. And that's from opening doors to other funders. It's to connecting people with others in their field or other folks we think they would benefit from. It's to being sometimes a cheerleader, sometimes an informal coach, sometimes a strategic advisor, a whole range of things, but it's really in response to what your partners are asking of you. And to me, I have found that part of the work the most meaningful in many ways over time is that part of my role.
Yeah, because you've taken the time. John, you've also had some great conversations with me about the dynamic between the trustees of a foundation. The trustees are the folks that actually, you know, they have the control over divvying out the grants and the money. They give the final decisions. And staff are consultants of a foundation. And how those two roles also are important to consider in relation to trust-based philanthropy, that it's not only how grants are given and how the relationship is built with grantees and nonprofits and charities, it's also what's that dynamic between trustees and staff. And it feels like you must have, and I love our conversations about this, and I'd love you to talk to our listeners about it, because, you know, you were staff of a foundation and now you are one of the trustees of your foundation. So I just would love you to delve into your ideas and principles there of how people can treat each other, both, you know, in the actual world of philanthropy there.
Thanks for that question. What we often talk about, those of us advocating for the trust-based approach, is we're really talking about building an ecosystem of trust. That's what we're striving for. And so it is, as you're saying, it's not just about the relationship between funders and nonprofits. It's between staff and their boards. It's between funders and other funders, nonprofits and other nonprofits. The aspiration is that you build these relationships both internally and externally. And I think for boards, that's especially important to look at that, and for staff and boards, because what we have found is it's the trust that the board puts in the staff that enables us to do this work. And there are some foundations like the Headwaters Foundation, who's one of the pillars of the trust-based project at the moment. They don't present dockets to their board. You know, the idea being, if you hire a professional staff, you hire consultants, you're trusting their judgment. And so the best use of their time is not putting in all this time to present the traditional docket to funders when they're based most of the time going to be approved. The amount of work I have heard over the years from fund, oh, it's docket season. Oh, it's, man, we're having to put so much work in this. And then, you know, the board see the binder and yes, yeah, most of the things are approved. And it's sometimes, I'm not saying all the time, but you go, is this the best use of everybody's time? And so for the board, one of the things to at least reflect and inquire about is if our role isn't this kind of gatekeeping of individual grants, then what is our role as trustees of the foundation? That's a different question. And I think a very fruitful one for boards to look at. And it's not that that individual approval for grants, if that's not there, they have no role. They still do. But their role within the grant making can be more of a strategic one. You know, what do we want our portfolio to accomplish? What's the makeup of the portfolio? How are we using our investments? How are we being an ambassador for the mission of the foundation? Again, it's kind of I mentioned this part about role, which you've been bringing up, because I think underneath a lot of the resistance to practice, you know, things that have been advocated for a long time, unrestricted funding being one of them, or multi-year funding, I think there's people are hesitant to really look at, well, then what would my new role be?
And that's so helpful there, John. What would the new role be? Yeah, what's the leaning in? And also being honest, if there isn't a new role, maybe there's redundancy and it's not necessary, and you can have space and time to do something even more productive.
Yeah. But I think kind of the moment we're in this, and this gets back to this theme of power sometimes. And if foundations are giving up more of this, their power, if boards are giving up some of their power, staff in different ways, I think then the question isn't just what are you giving up if you're letting go of these traditional practices, but what is that giving up allow you to step into? And so I think as we talk about shifting practice and philanthropy, if it's just you got to give this up or because you're doing it, this isn't the right way to do it, and you don't have a new role or a new invitation for people to step into, that makes change pretty problematic. So I think this question of role is really, really important. I talk about it in a more personal way with the Institute, just as anecdotally, because, you know, as kind of the second founder of this iteration of the foundation, being the executive director, I had invited the first board after Fred's death onto the board. When we made the decision to have Pia join me as co-executive director, as we looked to our spend out, and as over time, just through attrition, our board changed and the invitation to new board members shifted so that it wasn't just me, what I found was as I gave up some of my own personal power within the organization, we became a more powerful organization. And so I think when we talk about trust-based philanthropy and we talk about shifting power and we talk about rooting this work in strong racial equity values, values also of humility and service, it's that we're saying approaching the work in this way we find allows for work that is more effective, more meaningful, and more in alignment with what our aspirations are for what we're doing with our foundations. And so I think that's part of the moment we're in right now for anybody who's donors, funders looking to contribute. It's really looking at the invitation to step into new kind of roles that actually make the work much more fulfilling. But it entails letting go of some ego, letting go of some power, and letting go of some control.
John, beautiful, just beautiful. This was such a great interview. I don't want it to stop. I can't believe it's been already such a good chunk of time there. Oh, really, really wonderful words of wisdom there, John. And I'm going to have you back on in the future so we can dig into some of these.
Sure.
While you were talking, I had even more questions and thoughts and so many things. So, but thank you again for your time. And it's really exciting what you're doing. And I'm just glad you've put a name to what so many people have been thinking about for so many years. And you're sort of helping us think outside the box.
You know, I think one first thing, just again, thanks for the invitation to be part of your podcast. I've really been enjoying our conversations as well, both, you know, this taped one and others, and look forward to more. I think, yes, there's a lot of things we didn't really get into and talk about because we're spending out. We're closing our doors in just a little over a year. The issue of how much people are giving is also something we're talking a lot more about these days. A phrase someone used today that I think is a good one is talking about accelerated giving. Whether you're making the decision to spend out as a foundation, which we are, and I think more foundations do, or if you just give more right now, that's another whole issue to talk about, is how do we accelerate the giving? And we're really going, how do we fully step into our missions in this time and be serving our missions and not necessarily serving our endowments, which sometimes more often than I'd like to see, I think happens. That becomes the prime consideration. How do we protect the endowment? How do we build the endowment over time? And I think we are in times that are demanding that we rethink our assumptions about perpetuity and giving.
Thanks for that, John. Great conversation. I really appreciate all your time. And I can't wait to talk again. So there you have it. I hope you enjoyed this podcast as much as I enjoyed making it for you. So if you want to find out more about what I have to offer, please check out www.doyourgood.com and learn more ways to make your money matter. Until next time, do your good and be well.